Welcome today to an interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ambaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Raghu Rai, who transitioned from being a top university graduate to leading entrepreneur. Now, Raghu, thank you for coming in today and share so much of your expertise with our audience.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Stephen.
Now, Raghu, what areas interested you before college?
I've always been interested in entrepreneurship and healthcare. And so it really started when I was a young kid. My dad would always make me watch the 60-minute specials on Sundays, and you'd see these great profiles for entrepreneurs like Steve Jobs or Larry and Sergey. And so it was really exciting to see how they've built these companies over time, and that was always something that kind of piqued my interest. And then from the healthcare angle, I was always the one that was accompanying my grandparents or even my parents to their doctor's appointments. And it was kind of fascinating to see all of the inefficiencies at the time within the system, whether it was the lack of records or the lack of information. And so when I entered into college, it just seemed like the two very nicely coincided. And that's kind of what led me to where I am today.
Now, can you describe your college experience and milestones?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd actually studied biomedical engineering at the University of California, Irvine, and really got thrust into entrepreneurship during my first quarter of my freshman year. We'd actually been working on a project at the time where we were given an insulin pump and were tasked with innovating on top of it in some way. And this was back in about 2006, so the iPhone had just come out, and the first idea that popped into our heads was to connect the insulin pump to the iPhone, and that would allow patients to, control their insulin delivery, monitor their blood glucose levels, and share that information with their care providers all through mobile. The professor really enjoyed that project and encouraged us to enter into the campus-wide business plan competition, and at that point, really naively, I submitted an executive summary, and it ended up making it to the second round at that point, and in which case we got paired with a local business coach that ended up also becoming our first angel investor, but he kind of helped us craft a more formal business plan that ended up taking second place in the competition. And then from there on out, one of the greatest opportunities was having him see enough potential in the concept at the time to start assembling an advisory board of healthcare contacts and really start to prosecute the idea moving forward. So I spent the next 2 to 3 years just really exploring that idea and then transitioning in my senior year more towards what GeoHealth is today. But my entire college experience was really defined by building the company and exploring all the different possibilities behind it.
Now, Raghu, you've built up quite a bit of expertise in the healthcare industry as a result, and let's mine that for a bit. Can you talk about the research you have done and the advisors you work with?
Yeah, absolutely. Really, the research was very practical business research. After we had graduated back in about 2010, one of our advisors at the time was a gentleman that had come from the electronic medical record and connectivity fields. He had just come off of selling his company to a very large technology firm, IBM at the time. And one of the opportunities that he saw was in focusing on patient engagement. And we really felt that healthcare wasn't a challenge in terms of better drugs or better treatments or better therapies, but it was really the engagement of patients with those treatments and therapies that would lead to better outcomes. So one of the first research projects that we worked on was with a large hospital system in Southern California, and we focused on working with hypertensive and type 2 diabetic employees as part of a corporate wellness program. And the results of that study worked out really, really well. We had achieved a 98% rate of engagement with the prescribed wellness activities. And the real carrot that we provided these patients was a gamified wellness regimen. So each one of these patients would be encouraged to track their blood sugar levels, interact with their wellness coaches, comply with their medication routine, and in exchange they would earn points, and those points could then be exchanged for rewards such as pharmacy gift cards or Amazon gift cards, and that turned out to be a great model. And then more recently, we started focusing on a more acute healthcare problem, which is congestive heart failure. And in the United States, with the Affordable Care Act, one of the most pressing pain points for hospitals is to prevent 30-day emergency room readmissions, specifically for the diagnosis of congestive heart failure. And so we had worked with a very large insurance company nationally and a large IPA or physician group here in Southern California to address that problem. And that turned out to be a very challenging experience. But nonetheless, we were able to achieve $100,000 in savings in 3 months with a very challenging group that was not necessarily as tech savvy as we would have encountered in a younger population.
You know, it's just fascinating what you discovered. Now, what are some useful facts and major trends about the healthcare marketplace in North America and globally?
You know, there's really three key trends that I think dominate the healthcare landscape. And the first is accountable care. It used to be that a lot of healthcare was transacted on a face-to-face basis, on a patient-by-patient basis. And that model really contributed to an overgrowth of costs. Now the industry is more focused on demonstrating meaningful outcomes from each one of their care interactions. So every healthcare system is now tasked with demonstrating that they have actually improved the health of their patients and in effect have been accountable for their care well beyond just the visit. And a lot of reimbursements for the healthcare system are now tied to that performance. The second thing is, I think consumerization is a great trend. If you really ask any average American, they are probably not aware of what their healthcare costs or that they even have a choice in selecting their health plan. Here in the U.S., at the very least, many consumers have actually relied upon their employers to sponsor their health plans. But now that's really shifting with the individual mandates that that folks are getting from the federal government. So you'll see a lot more transparency in healthcare costs. And a lot of the burden of healthcare expenses is going to be shifting from employers to individuals. So you will be paying a lot more out of pocket. And I think that cost consciousness is going to become a lot more prevalent for consumers. And then the last thing that I'm really excited about is I think the delivery of healthcare is changing. And very much like Uber disrupted the transportation model or Airbnb disrupted the real estate and accommodations model, I think there's a ripe opportunity for startups to disrupt the delivery stage of healthcare by focusing on digital consultations, at-home visits, e-prescriptions. So everything is going to be digitized in the delivery of healthcare. You could actually be seen by your primary care physician in your living room through your iPhone screen versus having to go through, an endless wait in a waiting room or having to drive to these offices. So I think that's really exciting.
You know, we see that healthcare costs can be up to 17% of GDP for countries. And, as you've indicated, consumers increasingly want to engage in healthcare via their mobile devices, email, or et cetera. And what are some of the pain points in the industry and for enterprises in this space?
Yeah, one of the age-old problems for enterprises has always been connectivity. They don't like sharing data between one another, and there are a lot of efforts being made towards that by the federal government with the inclusion of technologies like Blue Button, which is an open API for electronic medical record systems to share what they call a CCD or continuity of care documents. And that'll make it a little bit easier, but it's still more not of a technology challenge, but more of an organizational challenge. The other challenge that we've observed is that you really have to scale your care resources to cover a larger population. So there really just aren't enough nurses and physicians to manage, you know, 30 million diabetics. And how do you extend your care to cover a broader audience with greater levels of risk? So I think that you're going to have to leverage technologies like mobile, and you're going to have to leverage technologies like social media or the web to really reach out and provide those patients with tools that empower them to care for themselves at some level. Otherwise, it would just inundate the system. And then lastly, I think an interesting stat that I've seen recently was with regards to consumer brand engagement in healthcare. And healthcare companies are actually performing very poorly in this category. I think the NPS score for most healthcare systems is in the low teens. And you take a look at some of their consumer counterparts like Amazon or Google, and each one of those brands is well above the 70s and 80s. So I think there's a huge opportunity to enhance the patient experience, especially as we're preparing for this consumer trend in healthcare.
Now, you just gave out a scoring system with an acronym. Can you explain that further?
Right. The NPS is a net promoter score. It's really used by marketers to determine the stickiness of a brand within the consumer's mindset. And so, you know, I was referencing more so brands like Amazon and Google having a successful presence within the consumer's mind, whereas healthcare insurance companies or hospital systems, they really suffered in terms of their brand recognition within the consumer's mindset. So there is a gap that I think could be filled.
So you talked about some of the solutions already, but can you go further into the solutions to the pain points?
Absolutely. You know, I think what we're focused on here at Geo, at the very least, is taking some of those persuasive elements of consumer technologies, you know, elegant designs, intuitive interfaces, the ability to integrate with wearables and sensors to pull data ambiently, the ability to share that data securely through your mobile interface. I think all of those digital touch points deliver healthcare in a context that's familiar to the patient. Patients don't like going onto the web and accessing a patient portal. It's a little bit cumbersome. Furthermore, I think that the healthcare system really has to take the approach that patients have to be in charge and stewards of their own data. So giving patients access to their records more freely allows them to then carry them along with them as they go from care facility to care facility and facilitate that care coordination. And lastly, I also think that with the advent of chronic diseases, you really have to focus on giving your patients tools that focus on prevention or management of day-to-day chronic ailments. So if it's a diabetes patient, you might want to deliver diabetes education, tools that help them track their blood sugar levels, tools that help them remind them to take their medications on time. Each of those things, though very small, small steps, add up to a large component of the behavioral healthcare costs that impact the system.
So I'm really curious then, what will healthcare look like in, let's say, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years?
Well, I know that you're a big fan of big data and machine learning, and I think it's going to completely transform all aspects of healthcare, everything from diagnostics to the delivery of healthcare. We're already seeing a greater amount of digital data resources like sensors and wearables. I believe that, you know, many healthcare systems have assembled enough historical archives of patient outcomes data. So, you know, that's the difference between a patient coming in for breast cancer at a with certain demographic data and then being able to cull through your historical records of all the patients that you've served and finding the best matched treatment plan with the highest level of confidence for that patient in terms of an outcome. Secondly, I also think that primary care is going to completely shift into the cloud. So once, where patients used to go in to see their general practitioner, that entire interaction is going to happen through digital. It's very costly to conduct primary care visits in office, and it's going to serve more as a gateway into channeling the patient into the right specialties of care. So you might post your symptoms or your chief concerns initially to a primary care physician through your mobile device, and then they would triage you to the correct specialist. And then lastly, I think that, again, that consumer trend, it's going to cause for a greater degree of competition within the space, which will allow patients to actually access health plans that have greater benefits and different benefit styles. And we're already seeing that there are some health insurance companies, like in New York, like Oscar, that have shifted some of their benefits to more digital consultations that are free on top of some of the other traditional benefits that other insurance companies have offered.
Now, there's so much attention globally to many areas, including healthcare. And can you share your views on the United Nations and the ITU and their efforts?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the sustainable development goals for the UN is good health and well-being. And obviously the ITU is focused on connecting the world through the web. So I think that those two go hand in hand. You know, our vision is really to be the best way to access healthcare. And we've even started exploring some opportunities in Southeast Asia with a few hospital systems. Primarily there's a large pediatric hospital in Hanoi in Vietnam that really looks at technologies like GEO as a potential for engaging with patients in remote provinces, engaging with mothers that are expecting to give birth much earlier and not putting as much stress on them to have to travel to these large cities. They're also looking at it as an opportunity to decrease the occupancy burden on their hospital systems. So I think that, you know, the great thing about digital healthcare technologies and the UN Sustainable Development Goals is that those digital technologies facilitate the reach and access of healthcare. And I don't really think that there's been an opportunity like that in the past where you could be in a rural village and be able to access healthcare without having to go through tremendous pressure and strain to travel or visit more urban areas.
So what prompted you to found a startup?
Yeah, you know, it really just serendipitously happened. I think that the interest was always there. And when you just kind of seize that opportunity by being connected to people like our chairman, Ken Roll, or some of our really great advisors, it really puts some momentum behind the idea that we're working on. And pretty soon you look back over the past 6 months and you're in the thick of it. And then you just love doing it so much where, you know, you're coming in and every single day is so dynamic and every experience is so new that you really don't realize it, but you're building a startup at a certain point. So I don't think there's any one reason behind it, but I think it's just embracing the right opportunity and feeling passionate about the vision that we've developed.
So you started very early and essentially out of college, and in fact, even beginning within college itself. What mistakes have you made?
Lots of mistakes. I think you really can't have a successful startup without mistakes. Initially, we began building our product without really reaching out to any users or customers. We didn't have any visibility we didn't really clearly understand our users and felt that we could really anticipate their needs. That's a big mistake, and I think that with the advent of some of those newer methodologies of the lean startup, they really talk about building a product that nobody wants. So we made that mistake a few times, and I think it actually was very sobering when you show someone an early prototype and notice that maybe 80% of your assumptions were slightly off or incorrect. So customer engagement was definitely one of them. I think focus is one of the most critical aspects of the startup. We felt that we could tackle anything and everything under the sun, but you really have to sacrifice many good ideas for that one great idea. So that's a consistent challenge that we face. But what you realize is that even a very specific vertical has a tremendous amount of complexity that's involved in its execution. So it's a fine balance of your resources and time, and then your business objectives.
So what are your successes and milestones currently and into the future?
Well, I'm very happy to see the performance that we've had in our healthcare pilots. 98% engagement in our early corporate wellness pilot was extraordinary. The cost savings that we accomplished at Monarch for the congestive heart failure pilot were great. Saving $100,000 in 3 months is a great feat. But I think now that we've shifted our focus towards more of a consumer healthcare model, I'm just excited by the reception that we've gotten with our early glimpses of our mobile app, and specifically how versatile it is in terms of being embraced by everything from wellness to a post-discharge at a hospital setting to a population management tool at insurance companies. So it's really nice to see the team that we've assembled and how they've responded so quickly in building the early version of our consumer product.
So I want to, you know, mine your experience so that you can share some lessons that will address the audience needs, that the audience, that is the listeners and readers of this podcast. You know, many of the audience are executives within enterprises, I mean, very, very large enterprises, and they may say, well, what's in this thing that I can learn from or I could use? Other people in this audience are highly technical professionals, and maybe they want to gain some insight as they progress their careers or as they try to drive innovation and agility into their enterprise. In other words, what kind of lessons can you give to these audience segments? And how can they use the startup mentality to drive innovation and agility?
Yeah, I think internal teams need complete autonomy from other business units. They need to have the ability to gain an outsider's perspective on the business problems that you're trying to tackle. You also need to encourage customer engagement from day one. So if there are key stakeholders that are impacted by some of these internal projects, that internal team needs to have full access to that stakeholder to truly understand and define the problem that you're trying to solve, and also to test your solutions and prototypes and iterations with. And I also think that there needs to be a strong definition of the business objectives that you're trying to accomplish with these internal projects, so you can constantly measure whether or not you're actually achieving your milestones or your the ends that you've wanted to accomplish. Other than that, it's really fail fast and fail often. So a culture of not frowning upon making mistakes or not quite hitting the mark every single time. There needs to be a tremendous degree of patience to really arrive at the right solution.
You know, it's kind of fascinating, and I guess you can maybe somewhat summarize some of that in, you know, like Eric Ries and Lean Startup, or Steve Blank in Customer Development, or Alexander Osterwalder with his Business Model Canvas. And what I'm hearing you say is that enterprises, when they're launching some kind of new product or service, or thinking about designing it, prototyping it, doing what we call a minimal viable product, they should engage external customers or stakeholders to get input, iterate quickly, try to figure out the best problem solution fit, the best product market fit, and do that quickly rather than waiting and doing a tremendous amount of investment. So keep it lean, keep it agile, employ something called DevOps, which is increasingly popular in the enterprise. Is that sort of what you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it sounds so logical after the fact, but you can really get a prototype or concept of your product out really, really quickly at low cost. And so I know that a lot of enterprises are exploring the development of mobile apps, for instance, that to help facilitate their business processes, or to even get themselves in front of consumers and into the consciousness of consumers. And before a single line of code is even written, you should really focus on just mocking out the front-end UI and sharing it with as many focus groups or people as you possibly can to determine if what you're even endeavoring to build is valuable in the first place. So I think you hit the nail on the head, Stephen. It's It's really about being, measuring twice and cutting once.
Well, something you said earlier is that it sounded like you are really supportive of the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. And I know in New York this week, it's a zoo, one because of the Pope visit and also because the United Nations General Assembly is in progress right now. And in fact, they're voting on the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, which runs from this year to 2030. So, and then you also talked about the ITU, which is a really old organization, by the way. It's about 150 years old. And they have this World Summit of the Information Society, and they call them action lines, which is really their goals. And they have 11 of those. How do you, health is such a universal issue. How do you see what you're doing integrating with those things?
Well, I had mentioned that we're working with a few hospital systems in Southeast Asia, and I think those markets are developing markets, so they don't really have as mature of a healthcare system in place at the current moment. And the challenge that they really have is delivering healthcare to a population that may not all be centralized in urban areas, delivering care to people in remote provinces, having access to information on risks in chronic disease populations that they really weren't able to process in the past. I was recently just in Vietnam, actually, about a week and a half ago, and I was visiting one of the largest hospitals there called Bac Mai Hospital. And it's fascinating that, the occupancy is triple what they can handle. Many patients that come into the hospital actually have ailments that could be treated from home. So there's a lot of unnecessary pressure that's being placed in the hospital itself. In fact, it's being seen as the only option for health care. There's not even a semblance of primary care. So I think by introducing technologies like geo or digital health to these new and developing populations, you could really educate those folks on accessing healthcare more remotely, understanding what conditions and symptoms they're currently experiencing, and maybe prescribing alternative routes of accessing healthcare, and then really making sure that if there is an emergency situation or if there is an acute need for healthcare, that you can reach a patient, hundreds of miles away. In a remote village and still guide them through some type of remedial steps before they're able to come into the care facility.
And I guess the other thing is that because of the advent of digital health, telemedicine, mobile health, a lot of it's either free or so little cost that it actually can make sense for developing and developed countries around the world. So the accessibility is just sort of so widely available.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very low cost, and in our case, it's actually free to the consumer. So we're really encouraging some of those hospital systems to enroll their patients into the technology to build that relationship outside of the care facility and to more properly manage those populations. But it's certainly a lot more affordable than hiring more nurses and doctors to manage that ever-growing population.
You know, I guess one of the things that you've discovered in the work that you're doing, but it's also found in enterprises and working professionals throughout the world, is that they have to work in teams. And you must then have some kind of idea, what are some of the key attributes in individual and team success in producing winning products and services?
I think it all comes down to conviction and a vision and communication. So every single day we're reinforcing the vision, and it's just to keep us focused on one objective. The thing that is probably the biggest vulnerability for any team is losing focus. And so every single day that we come in, our team is so motivated and excited, we might brainstorm 100 different ideas, but we may be only able to tackle one of them. And I think it's really about aligning the team to put the greatest amount of velocity behind your strengths and your core competencies, rather than trying to dilute the core purpose of your product and of your company. And then secondly, you know, our team is really unique in that it's a distributed team, so it's actually global. We've got to interface with not only folks here in the States, but also a larger part of our technology team in Southeast Asia. And that involves commitment, you know, late night talks, going through business requirements and technology requirements, and really keeping that communication flowing and smooth. So it's a very fine art, but as long as the team is motivated by the vision and they've got that conviction that what they're working on is truly going to make an impact, it keeps everybody on the same page.
You know, you bring up this idea of teams and so on, and I guess from an attribute standpoint, I just came across a recent study that, what was it now, something like over 50% of career success can be attributed to having something called open networks. Mm-hmm. And open networks are working with diverse groups. So in other words, if you have a team environment, make sure that you have quite a bit of diversity in that team environment. And I remember interviewing an authority in this area and trying to have as much diversity, but without having the team break, which can be difficult at times, but that could lead to a lot of success. Do you have any comments on that?
I think you bring up an excellent point. We have a very diverse team, and it lends to a broader understanding of healthcare, at least. We have a team here that's of all ages. You know, our investment team has gone through their own respective healthcare challenges personally, so they constantly inform our product development experience. Our team in Southeast Asia gives us the perspective into developing markets and a completely different way of looking at some of the challenges that we're facing. Even from a technology standpoint, I think getting a multidisciplinary effort from people of different areas like mobile or backend or data into the same room, or even UI and UX, it really forces you to examine not the technology but really the product, which is a combination of all those elements. So absolutely, the more open your network, the more relevant your solution.
Yeah, in fact, I'm just was thinking here while you were sort of providing your insight. I guess it is the number one predictor of career success is open networks. In fact, 50% of career success is due to open networks, and that is links with diverse people clusters. And I guess the research found that people who have open networks are better forecasters, first movers, and connectors, and have more disruptive innovations. And it's interesting that when they actually analyze millions of research studies, the best studies, that is the ones that are the most cited, all of them have at least 10% diverse references, and not just your typical references. So I just found that kind of fascinating. And then there's this other study in the Harvard Business Review where they studied a whole bunch of executives, about 3,000 executives, another 500 who started innovative companies and invented new products. And then sort of these 25 very, very disruptive innovators, one that are real game changers. And they found the innovative entrepreneurs spend 50% more time on five skills, and they call it an innovator's DNA. And the interesting thing is this DNA can be cultivated, and these five skills are questioning, observing, experimenting, associating, and networking. And the networking part of the question, observing, experimenting, associating, networking, the networking is really working with diverse people clusters or working with people that will that think differently from yourself. And that can lead to a lot of innovation. So it's interesting, some of your experiences in this area. Now, how do you know you have a winning product or service?
I think it comes down to just putting it in front of as many people as possible. Just like you said, we've displayed our product to quite a few diverse audiences, whether it's you know, folks within a physician organization or a hospital system or a health insurance company, and really have been collecting their feedback. And then the great thing now is that we have fewer barriers to access our customer because we're focused on the consumer. So everyone in our personal networks can actually comment on the product and continue to give us some meaningful feedback on the direction moving forward. So we're constantly measuring the response to our features, our functionality, And that gives a good degree of confidence in moving forward. And now as we start to develop more of a business model, it's engaging some of those larger enterprise organizations and understanding how they can benefit from having access to that consumer health data and employ it in their healthcare delivery practices. So just keeping a very, very close pulse on your target customer and constantly looking to them as the source of truth as you're building your product and your platform.
I have completed an interview with a gentleman by the name of Robin Pimentel, which is a kind of a fascinating guy. He helped build the infrastructure for Google, for Facebook, Yahoo, I think. I'm just going from memory, so I may have some of this wrong, but Gakkai, which was purchased by Sony, scaling these small data centers to be millions and millions of computers. And I saw him on my last trip to California go through an analysis of the user experience with another startup. And it was just fascinating where he went screen by screen and just every aspect of that screen, the feel, what it, what he thought would be challenges, things like just too many clicks or too many press points or maybe something wasn't quite intuitive. Do you go through that kind of detailed analysis?
Absolutely. I think it actually frustrates our technology team sometimes, but we will revisit things like the onboarding process a million times. Every pixel is examined. But the great thing is that you can do it at such a low cost that it doesn't really impact your burn rate, so there's no excuse not to do it. And typically where it begins is, just mocking up every single screen and creating a user flow and using prototype tools like Envision or Flinto and really getting it in front of users where you can actually simulate an actual, faux app and get some real-time feedback and commentary before a single line of code is even written. So we're constantly going through that. We've tested colors, brand colors, language, and just even used really great tools on the web like usertesting.com, which allows you to put your product in front of a complete third-party objective user and allows you to get unvarnished feedback screen by screen. I think it's the most critical factor that many people don't really see the technology behind the product. So the interface is really their only level of engagement with the product. You have to really nail that to get a successful outcome.
As you were sort of giving your response, I was thinking, have you ever considered using something like Amazon Mechanical Turk and just putting out a call for, 10,000 people to take a look and just give a small little fee to it or something like that?
That's actually very interesting. I'm familiar with Amazon Mechanical Turk, but I have not actually explored that. So that's maybe something for us to check out.
Yeah, in fact, I come across it periodically because I do work with the ACM, Association for Computing Machinery, and I notice that sometimes in our board meetings or other meetings, some people will bring it up. I just think it's just fascinating. And then I see news reports saying the same thing, that they have a particular problem and they're just an easy way of crowdsourcing human intelligence and at a mass scale and at a reasonable cost or very little cost, right? So just maybe a few closing questions before we end this interview, and that is, you're a pretty successful executive. You're the head of an enterprising healthcare company and from college onwards, and you're dealing with teams, in fact, a global team. Are there some leadership lessons that you feel have been successful for you?
I think that it's just about being open to learning every single day. So there are a lot of smarter people that specialize in a lot of the critical areas of our company that I possibly couldn't match in terms of their expertise. But how do you coordinate those efforts? How do you make everyone feel a greater sense of authorship in the process? I think that's my real responsibility. It's really being a chief editor of their efforts and contributions. So I think what you'd mentioned earlier, just opening up your network, being being a little bit more diverse in the people that you access. Working with folks that are a lot more senior and have the experience and being receptive to their feedback and wisdom. I think as a leader, you have to be a great listener. And so that's what I'm really trying to do on a day-to-day basis. And then secondly, the most chief responsibility that any leader has is continuing to direct the team towards a vision. That's got to be the common thread across all stakeholders, whether it's your investors, whether it's your board, your technology team, or even some of the early business stakeholders and customers that you're interfacing with. So it's to constantly refine the vision and to continue to listen to the people that are much, much smarter than you that are working with you.
Yeah, it's kind of fascinating. I'm just thinking, too, as you were giving your insight, I came across this data point that I thought was fascinating, and that is that there's over 133 now unicorns. And a unicorn, of course, is a company that has a valuation. It's a startup, that is, that has a valuation of over $1 billion. And to have over 133 of them worth about $500 billion, I just blows my mind that this is occurring at this stage. Why do you think this is happening that way?
I think it's because a lot of those companies are focused on targeting the consumer. So your market is enormous. And also it's about bringing those traditionally offline businesses online. So we've seen that type of disruption in e-commerce. Now we're seeing it in larger scale industries like with Uber and transportation, Airbnb and accommodations. Those traditional industries are now just being shocked and streamlined through the use of technology, and that's really why I'm really excited about the work that we're doing at Geo in particular, because healthcare is one of those traditional industries that's just ripe for disruption. You can change everything from how diagnostics are done to how a health insurance company manages a population, to even giving consumers the option of accessing their own personal physician without any middlemen directly through their iPhone. So it's going to be a challenge to keep pace with these rapidly evolving business models and startups that really anticipate them and embrace them early on. They'll leave the traditional industry far, far behind in the dust.
Well, Ranker, do you have any sort of closing comments? And then we'll end the interview.
I think that overall, I'm really focused on seeing the changes of healthcare, specifically at bringing more of a consumerization to healthcare. And I'm very excited about a lot of the work that's being done with the digital health startup community. And I think that the opportunity is amazing to also implement a lot of the lean startup principles to healthcare, which has typically been a very costly space to operate in. So I think that as we continue to move forward with Geo and implementing this product in the hands of consumers, that we're going to learn a lot more and really help a lot of people. So I'm very excited about that, and specifically also the fact that we can touch many lives globally. So our market isn't really even here in our own backyard, but it's a product that could be embraced halfway around the world, and that's very, very exciting. So I'm just very grateful for the opportunity, and really thank you for your time, Stephen, and giving us a platform to share our experiences and encouraging many other entrepreneurs and folks from this industry to do the same.
Well, Raghu, with your demanding schedule, we've been very fortunate to have you come in to do this interview, and we thank you for sharing so many of your experiences with our audience, and especially from somebody who's still quite young and yet innovating and producing disruption on a global level. And it's pretty exciting to get that kind of insight and to watch what you are doing and how you're changing the world and impacting the world. So thank you again.
Thanks so much, Stephen.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Raghu Rai, who transitioned from being a top university graduate to leading entrepreneur.